Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. The war's home front is a particularly active place at the moment because there are those here in our nation's capital who are determined to deny you free and fair elections going forward. It's hard to overstate just how critical that will be to the survival of our country and, as a result, the free world more generally. A woman who is in the thick of the fight over that particular piece of legislation, namely what's now known as S1 in the United States Senate, the so-called For the People Act, is our first guest. Her name is Jessica Anderson. She is the president of a terrific organization that is working tirelessly to try to, well, call attention to problems that are going on Capitol Hill and elsewhere in official Washington, and enable each of us to engage directly to make a difference in the outcome of such fights. She's at the Heritage Foundation's Heritage Action, Inc., and she is going to talk to us a little bit about what's going on this week. That is tomorrow, actually.
Thanks for having me, Frank. So as you mentioned, tomorrow, May 11th, the Senate Rules Committee is going to mark up S1, what we call the Corrupt Politicians Act. And this is a really important committee. Majority Leader Chuck Schumer personally sits on it, and he has filled the committee with his trusted allies, his trusted lieutenants, if you will. And so what to expect throughout the day, the markup begins at 10. I expect it'll go way into the evening as senators from both parties will offer amendments before the final vote in committee. And these amendments are going to be interesting to watch. I think for Republicans, they offer an opportunity for leaders like Senator Ted Cruz, in particular, Senator Cindy Hyde-Smith, Bill Hagerty, Shelby McConnell even, to come out and to offer the reasons why S1 is such a dangerous bill for the United States election system, how it would overcome and supersede all of our state-based election laws. It would do away with voter ID. It would create onerous tactics on state and local officials. It adds a 6-to-1 ratio for FEC financing. I mean, it's a whole host of issues, 600 plus pages in this bill. So the amendments I expect to come up are going to offer inflection points about the dangers of S1. And you're going to see it from both sides. Democrats are going to come out swinging in support for this. They want to see all felons given the right to vote, for instance. They want to see the Federal Election Commission be partisan and replace it with one-party rule, different than its bipartisan support right now. And they don't want voter ID at the state level. And so you're going to see them talk about this directly. You'll see Republicans respond. And you can follow the entire debate online with the hashtag Corrupt Politicians Act, where we'll be having rapid response and responding to the claims made by the left over this egregious bill.
And you have also provided a way in which people can actually register their views on this subject. Talk a little bit about how people can get access to some of the, not just the information about the legislation, but also the extent to which there are practical things that individual constituents can do at this critical moment.
That's exactly right. The only way we stop this bill after it leaves committee, before it goes to the floor, is if we amplify the voices of Americans, of voters all across the country saying, we don't want this. We don't want this. And there's four different ways you can get involved. One, you can hop online and you can register and speak out, get loud, as I've been saying, your discontent with this bill. Use that hashtag Corrupt Politicians Act on all platforms of social media to highlight the committee meeting, highlight the egregious policies. You can also write a letter to the editor to highlight the particular amendment votes that you may agree with or that you may disagree with. You can write op-eds on S1 in the markup meeting throughout the hearing. And then the fourth thing that I think is really so important is to register your discontent for the bill with senators. And you can do that at saveourelections.com. Type in your zip code. It'll hook you up directly with your senator and make your voice known. They need to know that American voters do not support this. We don't want it. And we're pushing back hard against this egregious bill.
Accountability for those in elective office is the name of the game. And the kind of information you can get through hashtag Corrupt Politicians Act and also a website that you have.
Everything that is a one-stop shop for the grassroots can be found at saveourelections.com, saveourelections.com.
Jessica, thank you again for your leadership on this and for helping all of us, whether we're engaged in these fights day in and day out or whether we're likely to be victims of them if they go bad, to play a role in trying to make sure that, in fact, they do come out right. And I wanted to ask you very quickly, there is another initiative, before we leave this topic of H.R. 1 and S1, the House and Senate versions, respectively. We're going to talk a little bit more about them momentarily with Bill Walton. But also to commend you for another initiative, and we're going to need to get you back for a longer visit about this, but just very quickly, introduce what you all are doing to raise awareness about and help counteract a particularly insidious threat to our country, also from within, called critical race training.
Yeah, critical race theory or critical race training is a incredibly significant movement that is racketing across our country, starting in our schools with children as young as an elementary school, all the way up through university and into corporate America. And what critical race theory does is it makes race the lens through which any aspect of American life is understood. So when critical race theory is applied, it underpins identity politics. It seeks to have an entirely new or reimagined view that the United States is a nation that was driven by racial groups, each with their own specific claims, each with their own specific victimization. And ultimately, what critical race theory, critical race training will do is it weakens the public and private bonds that create trust and allow for civic engagement. And even more than that, it's a distortion of American history.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's an attack against it.
Yeah. And it's attack against it. That's right. And the Biden administration is seeking to prop this up through a new rule. And so what we're trying to do is bring awareness to this, to stop it at the local level, and to push back against the Biden administration's proposed rule that would allow the Department of Education to prioritize K-12 grants. That's your and my taxpayer dollars to fund this up to include critical race theory in their curriculum. So if you want to learn more about this, visit heritageaction.com/toolkit/reject CRT. And you can find all of the background information as well as ways to submit comments to the Biden administration's Department of Education. Again, providing that accountability and saying, no, the American people do not want this.
Amen. And that needs to be done by the 19th of May. So get on this, folks. Check it out at the Heritage Action Inc. website. Thank you so much, Jessica. Come back to us soon. In the meantime, Godspeed on all of these vitally important projects. Next up, we'll speak with Tommy Waller, one of our duty experts on critical infrastructure, about the Colonial Pipeline attack and what it might mean for you right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to our next guest. He is one of my valued colleagues at the Center for Security Policy. He directs its infrastructure security program. His name is Tommy Waller. He happens, in his spare time, to be a United States Marine reservist, a lieutenant colonel, commanding one of our reserve companies of the Special Forces of the Marines, the Force Recon. He is an extraordinary asset and a real duty expert on the country's critical infrastructure, threats to it, and what the implications are if we don't address them properly. Tommy Waller, it's good to have you back on Secure Freedom Radio. Welcome to you, sir, and thank you for your great service to our country in so many respects.
Thank you, Frank, for having me on.
I wanted to talk to you particularly because, of course, we saw in the past few days a devastating, apparently, attack on one of our most important pieces of critical infrastructure, namely the Colonial Pipeline that runs through much of and feeds the needs, energy needs of much of the eastern part of the United States. Tell us about this pipeline system, how extensive it is, what was done to it, and what the implications seem to be so far.
Absolutely, Frank. Yeah, for a long time, we've been concerned that the Center for Security Policy has consistently talked about the need to protect all the infrastructure that supports our pipeline systems. There's two major pipelines that run from the Gulf Coast to the Northeast. The Plantation Pipeline, owned by Kinder Morgan, runs from Louisiana to the area of Washington, D.C. Much of it runs into this Colonial Pipeline. It's known as the jugular, if you will, of the Northeast when it comes to getting fuel. So gasoline, diesel, jet fuel. This pipeline transports 1.6 million barrels a day. So when you take a look at just the native production and contributions to that system from the Northeast, you're looking at maybe 65 to 75,000 barrels. That's all that they can produce natively and feed into it. Where you take a look at the contrast, the refineries in the Gulf, just one in Port Arthur, Texas, produces 630,000 barrels a day. And so this system produces just about, or moves just about half of the fuel that the Northeast needs. And that's something our enemies have long known as well.
So some enemy, and it's unclear at the moment which, did something the past Thursday, as you say. What was done? And again, what has been the effect on this vital pipeline system?
Well, sir, Thursday afternoon, for about 2 hours, what we think is a cyber gang named DarkSide, because that's who it's initially been attributed to in the media, took about 100 gigabytes of data out of the Colonial pipeline systems IT networks. And then it's known as a ransomware attack. So it's like a double extortion scheme. They steal the data, they encrypt it and lock it down, and they essentially threaten to either leak it to the public or the internet where all sorts of attackers could access it and exploit it, or until a ransom is paid, just maintain it. And so the Colonial Pipeline, the companies that own that pipeline system chose to preemptively shut it down to ensure, I think, that this ransomware wasn't infected into the different gators and control systems that actually operate the pipeline system. At the moment, Frank, it's unclear whether or not that's the case, but the result is still the same, that it's not pumping the fuel that it should be pumping to the Northeast right now. And its recipients of that fuel, I mean, it passes through 11 states and services 7 airports, multiple DOD installations around the country. So this is a huge deal.
That's Defense Department, our national security, in other words. And Tommy, that means that unless and until they reopen the pipeline, get it pumping again, we're going to see disruptions downstream that could be quite consequential for everything from consumers' access to gasoline for their vehicles, to air travel, to well, the Defense Department's missions, no?
That's right. Yeah, Frank, it's a logistics nightmare. So, of course, we're going to see the prospect of fuel shortages and fuel price increases. When you look at the refineries and all of the industry that contributes to getting us the fuel we need to operate, this is it's a huge deal. In fact, I spoke to my father yesterday about it. He worked for almost 40 years for an oil refinery. And when he described, on a daily basis, just one of these Gulf Coast refineries may take in 250,000 barrels of crude and produce, nearly 210 or so thousand barrels of gasoline, jet fuel, diesel, and lots of byproducts. At this very moment, these refineries, they can't put it into that system. So they've got to find ways to get it out of the refinery. They've got to plan ways to hold the crude off. And when you look at the second and third order effects, it's not just the fuel. There are so many byproducts from these refineries, propane, butane, precursors to plastics. Frank, you may remember just from the February blackout in Texas, a 4-day blackout in Texas has caused a global plastics shortage. This is going to exacerbate that problem just because of the precursors that come from petroleum products for those plastics manufacturers.
Now, Tommy, the question doubtless occurs for not only me, but lots of listeners. How could this have happened? How is it that we could have enabled people, whether they're, you know, essentially hackers without a country, or perhaps worse, actual enemies who are seeking to take down this country, to have gained this kind of control over so vital a piece of our critical infrastructure? And this is something, as you sort of alluded to a moment ago, that we've been warning about with the Secure the Grid Coalition that you have been leading so ably at the Center for Security Policy for quite some time. The question is, was somebody asleep at the switch? Were we neglecting the possibility of this kind of threat? And who should be held accountable for that?
Well, Frank, at the end of the day, those that own the infrastructure have to be accountable for the results of that infrastructure being vulnerable. The government certainly has a role to play. I don't know that the government's played a large enough role when it comes to pipeline security. So different infrastructures in the United States are organized under different parts of the government when it comes to critical infrastructure protection. For pipelines, it's underneath the Department of Transportation, specifically the Transportation Security Agency, or TSA. Now, as of 2019, GAO, Government Accountability Office, reported that TSA at that time had only 6 full-time employees working on pipeline security. So when you look at the importance of that critical infrastructure, it certainly doesn't seem at the moment that the federal government had levied enough resources or personnel. Ultimately, you and I have seen this on the electric utility side for a long time, trying to figure out, you know, what's the right governance and regulatory structures, and how do you incentivize these utilities or the infrastructure owners to do the right thing. And ultimately, while government has a role to play, and it should, I think really what it boils down to are the incentives and penalties that are financial in nature. So one thing that I saw that was inspiring is that as of just this week, one of the Europeans' top insurance companies, AXA, decided they're not going to continue offering policies, at least in France, that reimburse customers for payments made for ransomware hackers. So when you start to have capital investment, capital investors like Moody's, I think we've spoken before about they're waking up to these threats to different infrastructures when it comes to capital investment. Insurance companies waking up to this to say, look, if you don't protect it properly, we're not going to insure it. That's really, I think, going to make the biggest difference, although government, of course, has a role to play.
And Tommy, one of the things that we've been confounded by, of course, over the years at the Secure the Grid Coalition has been the degree to which the people who own this infrastructure have been seemingly intent on not protecting it, including engaging lobbyists to prevent or at least campaign against legislation or regulatory initiatives that would require the sorts of corrective actions that you're talking about. So this sort of private sector leverage is all the more needed because those lobbyists have proven, in many cases at least, have been highly successful in protecting the companies, but not ensuring that their customers, whether they're individual American citizens or whether they're, you know, governments of various levels, or for that matter, the Defense Department, as you've said, are going to be very badly served. So, Tommy, the question then, I guess, now is what can be done to unscramble these eggs? Is there anything that we as individual consumers can do, or what do you expect that the company, the government, and for that matter, the military will be doing next?
So I'm optimistic, Frank, that at least we should figure out the truth about what happened with this hack. You mentioned before the effectiveness by which the electric utility industry has been able to really what they call security through obscurity, right? So when electric utility gets hacked, or if they violate critical infrastructure protection standards, there's very little transparency for the public, for Congress. That's not the case with the pipeline companies. I mean, they don't have that gigantic layer of protection that's been established through that effective lobbying for the utilities. So one good thing is eventually we should learn the truth about what happened. It may actually be a situation where it can be addressed much faster because there hasn't been such a built-in sort of corporate response to say, hey, stay out of our business. In terms of what people can do, I mean, ultimately, you know, these are lessons for all of us. Texas, the Texas blackout should have been a lesson. People had to burn furniture to stay warm. Just being prepared, if you know you depend on certain types of infrastructure, fuel, having backups, having resilience planned in mind at the most local level possible is what I would suggest all the time.
A valuable resource for all of this is the Secure the Grid Coalition's securethegrid.com website. I commend it to you as I do the work of Tommy Waller. Tommy, I hope you'll come back to us regularly in the days ahead as this story, among others, vitally needs our attention. Thanks for all you do, my friend, at the Center for Security Policy. I know you'll keep it up. And, of course, in the United States Marine Corps. God bless you. Next up, we'll speak with Gordon Chang about a variety of new challenges and threats we're facing from communist China. We're back, and one of the high points of our week, each week, is our visit with the great Gordon Chang, one of our country's preeminent experts on the Chinese Communist Party and what it is up to in China and what it has in mind for the rest of us around the world. He's the author of numerous exceedingly important books, including The Coming Collapse of China, and most recently, The Great U.S.-China Tech War. You can find his writings, among other places, at Newsweek and at the Gatestone Institute. And you can follow him, as I do, at Gordon G. Chang on Twitter. Gordon Chang, it's good to have you with us, sir. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Frank.
So much to talk about, so little time. Let's start with the biological weapons program of Communist China. We don't know a lot about it, but there does seem to be growing evidence that it is real, it is aggressive, and it has some very ominous designs in mind for, well, various ethnicities around the world, including people of the United States. Talk about what we do know, Gordon, and what we should take away from that knowledge.
There was a recent report in The Australian, which is the paper based in Sydney, about a 263-page dossier, which is essentially a book about China's biological weapons program and its planning for World War III. Some people criticize the they know it's authentic, but they criticize whether it is official or not. But there is one thing we know, Frank, and that is China's National Defense University puts out a publication called The Science of Military Strategy. And in the 2017 edition of that, they talk about a new type of biological warfare. Now, this is official. And in that, they also mention, quote, specific ethnic genetic attacks, which means developing pathogens that would leave the Chinese immune and sicken everybody else. There's growing evidence that China has a biological weapons program. And I'm sure that in the not too distant future, that is something that we will conclusively determine, that the program does exist.
It does exist, and it is illegal. And I think that's a point that is not often mentioned in connection with these revelations, Gordon. The Chinese are party to a convention on biological warfare and weaponry that explicitly precludes its signatories from having such capabilities. And yet, they obviously have. They've built infrastructure, including, it seems, the Wuhan Institute of Virology, from which we increasingly, I think, have a consensus, was likely the source of the CCP virus. And we're just, it seems, not at this point remotely holding the Chinese accountable for illegal as well as highly dangerous activity, right?
Yes, China is a signatory to the Biological Weapons Convention. That convention has no inspections regime. And we should be clear here that the line between a biological weapons program and permitted research into biological weapons for defensive purposes is a very thin one. And China has gone over that line because it has a determined program from all that we can tell. I believe that we should not be a party to that convention unless there is an inspections regime, because at this point, China is going fast in this area. And remember, it's not just the development of pathogens. We know that China is collecting and massing DNA. They are preventing the transfer of Chinese DNA out of China. And as we have said before, if you want to find the largest collection of DNA profiles of Americans, you will not find that in our country. That largest collection of DNA profiles of Americans is in China. And that should give us concern, because what the Chinese are doing with our DNA.
Yeah, and what they may well do as a result of the research that big data enables them to pursue in the way of these ethnically configured biological agents, perhaps. Gordon, let me turn to another weapon that the Chinese seem to be involved in using against Americans, as well as the biological kind. Tell us what we know about these so-called sonic weapons, where they have been used, that implicate the Chinese and others, their friends, by the way, like the Cubans and the Russians. And what the effects of these particular weapons are.
Well, Cuba, China, and Russia have been using sonic weapons against American officials and diplomats for decades. We know of the incident, of course, in Havana at the end of 2016, as well as the incident in Guangzhou, the southern Chinese city, causing brain injuries to American diplomats in spring of 2018. The U.S. imposed no costs on Cuba or China. That would be the Obama and Trump administrations. So we shouldn't be surprised that there are now sonic attacks on American officials on American soil. 2019, 2020, we have sonic attacks against NSC officials, one on the South Lawn of the White House, the other in Arlington, Virginia. There are also indications, and this is unconfirmed, Frank, but there are indications that there have been sonic attacks on employees of U.S. companies, especially abroad in China. And this is an area where we need to learn a lot more. For instance, we don't know who was responsible for the 2019 and 2020 attacks, but, you know, we shouldn't be surprised. If we do nothing about the earlier ones where we knew who the culprits were, because those Cuba and China run near total surveillance states. No one could have launched a sonic attack on their soil unless the regimes knew about it. You know, if we don't do anything about that, well, of course our enemies are going to be emboldened and think they can attack Americans on America. The story here, Frank, is not that the Cubans and the Chinese and the Russians are, you know, criminals. It's that we're not protecting our own officials and diplomats and maybe our own corporate employees. So this is shame on us.
Well, I don't want to let them off the hook for being criminals. They are, indeed. As we've discussed before, Gordon, I think it's accurate to describe the Chinese Communist Party, especially, as a transnational criminal organization. And these sorts of crimes against humanity are just a small sample of what they are doing in vastly larger quantities and of people affected, of course, in the genocide in Xinjiang and so on. But Gordon, very quickly, these attacks on the White House grounds, for example, that's stunning to me. And we know that it was an attack because the symptoms were immediately evident. I had thought in many cases in these other places where this has taken place, there was a passage of time and it became unclear, you know, what prompted the symptoms. This sounds different.
Well, in the China case, the victims heard loud sonic piercing noises. They heard it over a period of time and they suffered brain injuries. We have no report on injuries from the 2019 and 2020 attacks on our soil, but the targets there did hear a similar loud piercing noise and then experienced symptoms. though they were mild in our case, perhaps because they were not sustained attacks on American soil. But as Rick Fisher, a friend of ours, has said, you know, in a wartime setting, you could see the Chinese and the Russians, maybe the Cubans, setting up sonic trucks on the bluffs overlooking the Pentagon, and just then sonic attacking the entire American military establishment before hostilities begin.
Gordon Cheng, one other instrument of warfare that the Chinese use with very considerable effect is the subject of another of your recent essays, was written up in Strategica, a publication of the Hoover Institute recently, namely China's propaganda. The subtitle of it is Ludicrous, Malicious, Yet Extremely Effective. Talk about that as an instrument of warfare and what we're doing to enable it to be used against us here in the United States.
Well, China has the most expansive, heavily resourced, and sophisticated propaganda operation in the world. They have been at it for decades, but recently they have ramped up their propaganda attacks on the United States. And this is, we enable this in a sense because we allow China's media outlets in our country where they don't allow ours in theirs, except under very limited and restrictive circumstances. So we need to sort of enforce reciprocity here. But also we've got to understand the maliciousness of this, because last year, China's propaganda really meant to incite violence on American streets. So that's more than just subversion, Frank. That is an act of war. And there are some indications that China has continued this violence-inciting propaganda this year as well. This is, again, our country. We permit this to happen. And what we need, of course, is for our political leaders to end this. We can end this. We have the tools to do this. But so far, we don't have political will. And by the way, that's not just a criticism of the present occupant of the White House. This goes back to his predecessors.
I'm afraid you're right. We, first of all, seem to turn a blind eye to it, failing to understand just how insidious it can be as part of a larger influence operation campaign designed to take us down from within. Gordon Cheng, thank you for raising a flare on this very important topic, as well as the others we've discussed today, and for all that you do at the Gatestone Institute and elsewhere. And again, folks, follow Gordon at Gordon G. Cheng on Twitter. Come back to us again next week. Thank you so much, my friend. God bless you. Next up, we will be speaking with Bill Walton about H.R. 1, the worst piece of legislation in the history of our country, arguably, and what our capital markets continue to do to underwrite the Chinese communist threat. That and more right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, and it's time for our weekly conversation with Bill Walton, a former Master of the Universe on Wall Street, as Tom Wolfe calls them, and now a leader of conservative thought and policy in, among other capacities, his program, his podcast television program, The Bill Walton Show, and also as president of a terrific organization, the Council for National Policy, which I'm very proud to be associated. Bill Walton is a good friend of this program and a valued contributor. We're always glad to have him with us. Welcome back, Bill.
Frank, delighted to be talking with you.
Tomorrow, Bill, something we have been dreading for some time is moving forward, evidently, and that would be S1, the legislation that roughly parallels HR1, which has been, I think, accurately described as the worst piece of legislation in the history of this country. Remind us what these bills are about and what we might expect out of this markup tomorrow in the Senate Rules Committee, and what people listening to this program should be doing and saying about that markup.
Well, to refresh everybody's recollection, H.R. 1, the House bill, now is going over to the Senate, and it's S1, and it essentially enacts federal law that ensures that most of the abuses that we saw during the 2020 election are made permanent. And there are all sorts of great things in there, like states are not allowed to require photo voter IDs or they can't clean up their voter rolls, and it really enshrines every single bad thing that happened in November 2020. Now, the states are working, a lot of the state legislators, Republican state legislators, are working very hard at the state level to make sure that their election processes are cleaned up. But it's unclear how this federal legislation is going to interact with state legislation. And of course, we've seen, you know, you and I have apoplectic about these woke corporations, these major corporations who feel like it's in their portfolio that they need to weigh in on these election laws. It's pretty egregious, and we're going to have to do everything we can to stop this. We've been sounding the alarms. I'm not sure where the votes are in the Senate. I mean, we're always talking about Joe Manchin, and there's a Kristen, the woman from Arizona. Anyway, there's another one in there, some that may not vote for it. But this thing hangs by a thread. And of course, if it goes through and it's envisioned format, I think we can kiss free and fair elections goodbye.
Bill, this is all the more astonishing, given what's going on in one of those states, Kristen Sinema's, as it happens, Arizona, where we're watching the forensic audit ordered by the state Senate in light of abundant evidence of irregularities, misconduct, and outright fraud in that election. The sorts of things that you're saying H.R. 1, S.1 would enshrine, make permanent in federal law nationwide. We're watching this play out because with each passing day, it seems, Maricopa County's Board of Supervisors and others in the county government there, where this audit is taking place, and the state's Secretary of State, and now the federal Department of Justice are all seeing what they can do to interfere with, or if possible, actually terminate this forensic audit. What, again, are we to make of this, Bill, in terms of this concern about electoral integrity? And, I call it electoral grand larceny in 2020.
Well, Maricopa County is one specific instance. The bigger issue for me is that Obama stocked the Justice Department during his two terms with people who were left of, you know, unbelievably on the left, progressive left, and they never left the building. They're career employees, and now we've got Biden appointees in the Justice Department, and they are not friends of freedom. And so we've got the full weight and power of the Justice Department weighing in on the side to prevent free and fair elections. Very troubling. And, you know, I always come back to the personal. I think we've got to take a look at who in the Justice Department is behind this and maybe start shining a light on what they're doing. Because you look at who these people are and you look at their biographies, I think most Americans would be appalled.
Appalled indeed, I think, and really angry, I suspect, perhaps not all, but enough of them to be a problem for those elected officials. You bet I am. But the point is that those who are now contemplating voting to enact this kind of stuff with the growing evidence of wrongdoing in 2020 should be on notice that the wrath of the voters will be upon them. I think there's no doubt about that. Let me ask you, Bill, about another issue that I think would infuriate most Americans. Your former colleagues on Wall Street have been putting our money, by some estimates, to the tune of $3 trillion of it since 2013, when Joe Biden helped launch a mechanism whereby the Chinese Communist Party's companies did not have to conform to our laws and regulations to sell their stocks and bonds on our capital markets. We're watching an underwriting of our enemy by Wall Street. And I use that term advisedly, but as Gordon Chang's just pointed out, these guys are talking about using biological weapons to destroy us. How can you consider them anything other than an enemy? And how can we possibly be enabling their malevolent behavior with our pension funds, with our savings, with our investment portfolios and the like?
Well, I wish this is something that Larry Fink at BlackRock would weigh in on. He's weighing in on all the environmental issues. He's turning a blind eye to China. This is another...
At worst, he's up to his eyeballs in it.
Well, yeah, maybe not blind eye, a gimlet eye, whatever he's doing, whatever the eye is. But my point is this, it's just so tragic that the Trump administration is no longer on the job, because we were beginning to do things like, guess what? If you're a Chinese company under the old regime, you didn't need to have audited financial statements, or at least audited statements that could be certified. So it meant that, you know, they could get away with murder and had very little financial disclosure. And of course, most of these big companies that are raising money here in the United States or in the U.S. capital markets have plenty of Chinese Communist Party members on the board. They're effectively state-run companies. They've been raising money in U.S. capital markets to fund companies, many of which are in the biological warfare business or in the, you know, the IT or internet business with aims to, to come after America. So
yeah. Surveillance states, the Uyghur Muslim oppression, on and on and on.
But Frank, every week you remind me I used to be on Wall Street. That's really unfair.
Listen, it gives you standing to talk about this, Bill.
Well, I do know what they're doing.
I think you're a recovering master of the universe, but you are a master of the universe. But the point is, what you have an insight into what these guys are thinking. And is it possible to describe it as anything other than their own personal short-term, you know, greed?
Let me give you a story from my Wall Street days. I was in a firm, Lehman Brothers Kuhn Loeb, and we brought in a general just recently left the Army, and we always wanted rainmakers. And this general came into our first M&A meeting, and he was sitting there, it was a Monday morning, and we started talking about underwriting the securities for this particular company. And he started talking about, well, you know, this company is really good for the country, and we can do this for it, and they're really run by great people. And all the people in the meeting, all we wanted to talk about was how much we were going to charge, what the fee was going to be. And you know, greed is not something that's disappeared from Wall Street, and you get people that are motivated by getting underwriting fees, and you know, a couple percent, 3-5% of $1 billion is a lot of money. Pays for a lot of houses in Westchester,
or at least one. But with the price of real estate these days. But the point, Bill, is that you know, at least you were looking at doing something with a company that was American and, you know, in
their
national interest, as opposed to working for the Chinese, full stop. Bill, we have to leave it at that for the moment.
It was 30 years ago, yeah.
I understand, but still, that was an important distinction from what we're seeing today.
More stories for you, Frank.
I would love those stories. That's one of the reasons why we love having you on. Bill Walton, thank you for your time and for all you do for our country. Keep it up, my friend, and come back to us next week. We'll talk to the rest of you, I hope, again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.